Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We begin with the rising death toll in what appears to be a resumption of the Sunni-Shia civil war in Iraq that General Petraeus's much-praised surge was supposed to have ended. Iraq expert Juan Cole joins us to discuss the impact that the Syrian civil war is having on the restive Sunni Anbar province on the Syrian border that has become a haven for jihadists of the so-called al-Qaeda in Iraq. Then we'll assess the extent to which the much-touted shift to cheap and abundant natural gas as a less polluting source of energy that will reduce greenhouse gas emissions causing global warming is a lie. Deborah Goldberg, the managing attorney at Earth Justice, joins us to discuss how the benefits of the natural gas boom that has the U.S. surpassing Russia as the world's biggest producer are offset by the leakage of methane from fracking, which causes seepage of methane, a far more damaging greenhouse gas, 30 times worse than CO2. Then finally, with the leadership of the Republican House unable to calm their own caucus, threatening to shut down the government again, we'll look into the philosophical underpinning of the Tea Party radicals bent on sabotaging the government no matter what the consequences are for the nation. Michael Lind, the co-founder of the New America Foundation and author of Land of Promise, an economic history of the United States, joins us to discuss his latest article at Salon, How Did Ayn Rand Become a Hero of Right-Wing Nerds Everywhere? And joining us now is Juan Cole, who's a professor of modern Middle Eastern history and South Asian history at the University of Michigan and president of the Global Americana Institute. He's the author of Sacred Space and Holy War, The Ayatollahs and Democracy in Iraq, Napoleon's Egypt Invading the Middle East, and Engaging the Muslim World. He's also the author of the blog Informed Comment at JuanCole.com. Welcome to Background Briefing, Juan Cole.
Thanks, Ian.
And according to the United Nations, 1,057 Iraqis were killed and 2,326 were wounded in attacks in July, which makes that the highest casualty figure since 2008. Are we to assume that the Sunni-Shia civil war that General Petraeus was supposed to have ended with his surge, is that resuming or could it resume?
No, it's a different phenomenon now. In 2006-2007, you had a civil war which was pursued on the ground, and it involved ethnic cleansing of Sunnis from Shia neighborhoods and vice versa. And you had as many as 2,500 people killed per month in that period. Now, that ethnic cleansing has happened, and a lot of neighborhoods are fairly monochrome. You have to drive for a while to find somebody of the other sect if you wanted to kill them. And so what's going on now is a guerrilla war. It's a low-intensity conflict by guerrillas, by cadres who are blowing things up. They're interlopers into the places, like the Shia neighborhoods that were blown up on Saturday. The people who blew them up don't live there. They came from elsewhere. So it's not a civil war. It's a guerrilla war.
So apparently the leader of al-Qaeda in Iraq, he's apparently based in Syria. This is Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. The fact that he's named al-Baghdadi, is that anything to do with the Sunni bitterness over Baghdad, which used to be a Sunni city, having become a Shia city thanks to the United States intervention?
Well, that's an astute observation, Ian. I hadn't thought of it, but it's entirely possible. There is a great deal of fury among Sunni Arabs about what they see as a Shiitization of Baghdad. The city probably had a slight Shia majority in 2003 when the U.S. invaded. I suspect it's now 75 or 80% Shia. And the Sunnis have been ethnically cleansed from a lot of its neighborhoods. Many of those neighborhoods are dark at night, as shown by satellite photos, and they've been forced to go elsewhere to Mosul or other Sunni cities. Some of them had been forced to go as refugees to Jordan and Syria. But of course, Syria now is such that people are either coming back or trying to get elsewhere.
So in terms of General Petraeus's much-touted surge, I've talked to a number of senior military officers who are less than enchanted with General Petraeus, who, of course, has become a hero in with the American press. And a lot of people suggested that he cultivated the press in order to get that kind of reputation. But my understanding from officers who served in Iraq, at least, you know, this is not necessarily a cross-section of them, but those that I've spoken to think that Petraeus is basically a political general, and the reason he got his fourth star was that he basically saved Bush and Cheney's bacon, that they were completely trapped in Iraq. They didn't know what the hell happened to them and how to get out of it, and they didn't obviously listen to first of all, Bush didn't listen to his father, who I'm not sure or even talked to him about the folly of going into Iraq, but they certainly didn't listen to Brent Scowcroft and others who warned that this would only benefit Iran, which has been clearly demonstrated. So is that what really Petraeus did and what the surge was, just a way to give Bush cover to get the hell out of there?
Well, Petraeus had a theory of counter-terrorism and counter-insurgency, which he attempted to apply in Iraq. And I think it did have some effect in some places for a while. But I actually think that both Petraeus and the Bush administration caught a break, an unexpected break, from the Iraqis themselves. Because the ethnic cleansing campaign in the Civil War petered out in summer of 2007, around the time that the surge was reaching its peak. And so, you know, in the statistics, you always have to be careful when you find an association because it might not be causal. It looked to Petraeus and others as though they had succeeded in tamping down the violence. In my view, the violence subsided because there just weren't any more members of the other sect in those neighborhoods. They'd been ethnically cleansed. And so you did see a downtick, very substantial, in violence, but I think it had very little to do with the surge. And if anything, the American troops targeted the Sunnis to disarm them and probably inadvertently, in fact, certainly inadvertently, allowed the Shia militias to intensify their ethnic cleansing campaign in Baghdad. And I've been told this by junior officers who watched it happen on the ground quite helplessly. The other thing that happened was that Nouri al-Maliki finally figured out how to be a prime minister and managed to get control of the new Iraqi army. He established forward operating bases. He had the officers report directly to him. He cultivated tribal militias, and he took on some of the militias in 2008. So between the increasing power and efficiency of al-Maliki and the new army and the end of the ethnic cleansing campaign, it was possible for the United States to hand Iraq back over to the Iraqis and leave. But I think it had ultimately relatively little to do with Petraeus or his counterinsurgency campaign.
And again, I'm speaking with Juan Cole, who's a professor of modern Middle Eastern and South Asian history at the University of Michigan and president of the Global Americana Institute. He's the author of Sacred Space and Holy War, The Ayatollahs and Democracy in Iraq, Napoleon's Egypt, Invading the Middle East, and Engaging the Muslim World. He's also the author of the blog Informed Comment at juancole.com. And we're talking about the increased sectarian bloodshed in Iraq and whether that will lead to a resumed civil war or lead to resumption of the civil war. Now, clearly, what's happening next door in Syria is impacting Iraq in a very, very dangerous way. My understanding is that the Anbar province is where the insurgents are able to infiltrate into Iraq, and arms go in that way. And there was recently, by the way, a group of Alawites. They were Syrian soldiers were murdered on that border by the insurgents. So the extent to which the Bush administration, one of their lies about getting us into the Iraq war was that Iraq was a haven for al-Qaeda, that somehow Saddam Hussein was playing footsie with al-Qaeda, which, of course, was an absurdity at the time. But ironically, it appears to be, in fact, the case now that al-Qaeda is actually in Iraq.
Well, you know, there's a Sunni Arab resistance to the new order, which is dominated by Shiites and Kurds. And that resistance takes various forms. It can be neighborhood-based. It can be urban-based. There are various cells involved. And some of them, you know, use Al-Qaeda as a kind of franchising tool. Be afraid of me. I'm very bad. I'm Al-Qaeda. But I don't think there's any command and control from Ayman al-Zawahiri or Al-Qaeda Central in Pakistan. And I think a lot of those guys are just very angry Sunni Arab young men who don't like the idea of their country having been reformulated by the Bush administration, and who are determined not to let the new order congeal. So, to the extent to which very many of them are driven by extremist ideology, I think is really up in the air. I mean, such groups do exist. They are important. They are competent. They have access to high explosives. And I don't mean to downplay them. But I think there are a lot of people who support them, and there are some militant groups operating who aren't necessarily very Islamic in their ideologies. And I think there's a tendency in the to use Al-Qaeda's franchising aspect to sweep everything into a single movement. Which is, in fact, the situation on the ground is quite complex.
Well, what does appear to be clear, though, is that Iran was the winner of the Iraq War, and that the fact that the United States can't get al-Maliki's government that they put into power to cooperate with them over stopping Iranian overflights to resupply the Assad regime in Syria would I think, brings that into a rather obvious frame. So what are the consequences, do you think, of the one thing that is apparent about the Syrian situation is that the Iranians and the Russians and Hezbollah seem to be quite determined to have Assad win, whereas the West don't seem to be sure what they want there and who they want to win and who's fighting on their behalf. And my understanding is that Assad, for example, doesn't really target the al-Nusra, the al-Qaeda-type militias, as much as he does the more secular Free Syrian Army, and that U.S. vacillation over supporting the Free Syrian Army has led to their marginalization and essentially the momentum in terms of the rebels have shifted largely to the radicals. So is that what you understand?
Well, certainly that's the general shape of things. There is a kind of axis of Russia, Iran, Iraq, and Lebanon with the Ba'ath government of Syria. I think, you know, it's not an ideological axis. I don't think it's a Shiite crescent sort of thing. I think the Hezbollah wants the government to remain in power in Syria because it's the land bridge over which those rockets come from Iran. And without that land bridge, Israel could besiege Hezbollah and destroy it and reoccupy southern Lebanon if it wanted to. So it's life or death for Hezbollah, and I don't think the fact that the government is dominated by a form of heterodox Shiism, you know, the Alawis in Syria are considered Shia, but they are sort of the New Age Santa Monica-style Shia with a lot of mythology, and they're not. I mean, Hafez al-Assad, the father of the president, actually had to undergo a conversion to formal Shiism to be accepted as a Muslim. So it's not a it's not a sectarian thing. I think it's realpolitik. And Nouri al-Maliki, who hated the Ba'ath government in Syria, had lived in Syria for nearly 20 years, plotting the overthrow of Saddam. Used to blame Bashar al-Assad for every bombing that happened in Baghdad. If you go back and look at the press in 2007, 2008, and only in the past 2 years has al-Maliki swung around and begun supporting al-Assad, and it has nothing to do with Shiite or not Shiite, but it's because al-Maliki is afraid that the Sunni extremists will take over Damascus, and then they'll help his Sunni opponents inside Iraq. So for these various reasons, there is now this Russian, Iranian, Iraqi, Syrian, Lebanon axis, and it's certainly not what the neocons were going for.
And if Assad loses, there's likely to be a ripple effect, is there not, into Iraq itself and perhaps embolden the Sunnis in Anbar? Is it possible that you could end up with a partitioned Iraq? I mean, for all intents and purposes, the Kurdish part of Iraq in the north is a separate state.
Yes, the Kurdish part of Iraq in the north is the Taiwan of the Middle East. It is an independent state, but you can't say it without causing a war. And indeed, they've just announced that they're going to build a moat around the city of Kirkuk, which is technically not in Iraqi Kurdistan, but in the province of Kirkuk. And however, the Kurds are saying for security reasons they have to build this this trench around it. That's a very stark kind of partition. The Sunni Arabs in Iraq have traditionally been Iraqi nationalists, and I think very loath to give up the idea of being in Iraq or being Iraqis. But you have begun to hear talk among some prominent Iraqi politicians of leaving if they're stuck with someone like Maliki forever. And if Damascus, if Damascus fell to the Sunni Arabs, you know, it's not completely impossible that you'd have a 1989 German moment in which Mosul and Fallujah and so forth just declare for Damascus. I mean, one Iraqi politician said that for the first time since World War One, the Sykes-Picot Agreement that drew the boundaries of the modern Middle East by the imperial powers might be up for renegotiation.
Well, Juan Cola, thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Juan Cole, who's a professor of modern Middle Eastern and South Asian history at the University of Michigan and president of the Global Americana Institute. He's the author of Sacred Space and Holy War, The Ayatollahs and Democracy in Iraq, Napoleon's Egypt, Invading the Middle East, and Engaging the Muslim World. He's also the author of the blog Informed Comment at juancole.com. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the extent to which fracking for natural gas is offsetting the values or the benefits of natural gas itself. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Deborah Goldberg, who's the managing attorney at Earth Justice, where she supervises and conducts legal advocacy and litigation related to global warming and environmental health. She served as a law clerk for then Judge Stephen Breyer, now of the Supreme Court, on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the First Circuit. And before joining Earth Justice, she was a democracy program director of the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University School of Law. Welcome to Background Briefing, Deborah Goldberg.
Thank you very much.
And the U.S. is apparently about to surpass Russia as the world's leading producer of natural gas, and there's been a tremendous shift in this natural gas boom that's taking place at the expense of coal, and everybody seems to be celebrating the idea that natural gas is much, much less polluting in terms of global warming gases than coal. But my understanding is that because of this sort of fracking that's going on in a kind of Wild West way across the country, that there's a growing awareness that the seepage of methane might offset whatever benefits we get from the less polluting natural gas.
Yes, that's right. The production right now that is going on from shale, which is a relatively new development, causes the release of methane at many different points during the process. The fracking itself, particularly if it's done fast and furious, as it has been with the boom that we've seen recently, releases methane into the air. And throughout the production and transmission process, we have other places where the methane is released, whether it's from processing facilities or from pipelines, or because there have been accidents and the methane's been released into groundwater and now is just venting into the air.
But if you do this fracking, whether you do it well or as, you know, as some oil companies suggest that they do it properly, and others, the more freelance types, I guess, do it improperly. Either way, it would seem that if you inject this high-pressure water and these very noxious chemicals deep underground to break open the shale, isn't it logical that fissures would form, not necessarily in exactly the spot where you have the wellhead?
Well, those sorts of things happen all the time. There's a term that the industry uses for them, which they call it fracking out of zone. The industry, of course, wants to avoid doing that because if they actually connect up to pre-existing fissures that can take the gas either to water or potentially ultimately to the air, they lose the products that they're trying to mine in the first place. But that doesn't mean that it doesn't happen. And it isn't just the fracturing process also. A lot of the problems that we've been seeing are from the drilling process. That's where we see most of the methane into migration into groundwater. And there is just a certain amount of methane that comes to the surface with the wastewater. So quite apart from whether or not the fracturing itself was done properly, there's still releases at the surface with the fracking process.
So who's calibrating and quantifying the leakage then? Because my understanding is that natural gas, methane, is 30 times more polluting than CO2. It's an exponentially worse greenhouse gas.
Well, over a 100-year period, it is believed to be about that much more polluting of the atmosphere. Over a 20-year time scale, you know, it could be as much as 100 times more potent than CO2. And, of course, we're very concerned about the short-term impacts because we don't have a lot of time right now to get our carbon dioxide equivalent numbers down to the point where we aren't going to face catastrophic climate change. So your question, you know, who is measuring it, is a very good one, because actually there's not a great deal of systematic measurement taking place. The industry is exempt from some of the requirements of the Clean Air Act that would require that they actually record the emissions of their facilities. And so we are now dependent upon independent types of research that are going on, and we don't have enough of that at this point to have a clear sense and real confidence that we even know how much of this is being released into the air.
Again, I'm speaking with Deborah Goldberg, who's the managing attorney at Earth Justice, where she supervises and conducts legal advocacy and litigation related on global warming and environmental health. She served as a law clerk for then Justice Stephen Breyer, now of the Supreme Court, on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the First Circuit. And before joining Earth Justice, she was the Democracy Programs Director of the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University School of Law. So, what is the industry admitting to then in terms of methane seepage from fracking?
I don't know that the industry collectively is admitting to any particular amount. What the industry will tell you is that there's much they can be doing to control it and we shouldn't worry about it. But the fact of the matter is the industry, for the most part, is not adopting the measures that are necessary to control it. We don't have green completions, which means that the gas is sent immediately into pipelines in much of the country. So, for example, most recently in the Uinta Basin in Utah, the National Oceans and Atmospheric Agency Administration did a study of the methane over that field and found that it could be to a 95% significance level anywhere from 3% to 14% of the production levels actually just being emitted into the air. What we know is that at 4%, we lose the entire climate advantage that natural gas has over coal. And we've seen previous studies, also empirical studies by this administration, suggesting that there was at least 4% in other basins. So we are potentially already at a level in many basins that have been intensively developed where we are well beyond the level that would give us the climate advantage over coal.
So how is the seepage measured? Is there any empirical way to measure it so that, because fracking's going on all around the country, and it obviously people that do it are more concerned about getting their product to market than they are about whatever the side effects might be. So surely it's incumbent upon the EPA or somebody to look into this matter, because this whole thing, we may be worse off in the long run than without this fracking going on.
Absolutely. And there are instruments that can be used to measure methane emissions. If you're at a particular valve or at a particular processing facility, you can measure emissions directly from the equipment. And EPA, in fact, develops what they call sort of emissions estimates based on equipment to project what emissions might be when there is gas development. The problem is that, first of all, not all of the emissions are from the equipment, and also these are just estimates. They're not actual empirical data. There's also equipment that can be used to measure empirically how much methane is released. NOAA used it over the Uinta Basin and the Julesburg Basin in Colorado to measure methane that's been released over those fields, and they can distinguish between methane that is coming from the oil and gas development and methane that's coming from other sources. What they can't do when they have these overflights or satellite testing is identify precisely what part of the gas development and transmission system is releasing the methane. So we get the empirical basin-wide data, and then we have emissions estimates from the equipment. But we don't, for example, have any idea how much is being released through just bubbling up from bad wells into groundwater or surface water and then into the air.
But Deborah Goldberg, aren't there many, many examples of methane bubbling up? This fracking mania started in Pennsylvania. I've seen film of
yes.
Tell me about what we know about it, that.
Well, we know that there's massive amounts of gas migration into groundwater as a result of the oil and gas development process. It's typically taking place during the drilling process. The wells are inadequately cased and cemented, and then when the drilling is done, it causes migration of the gas into the formations, toward the surface of the well. The fracking itself potentially could do that, but what we are principally seeing is that before you even start the fracking, you're getting the gas migration into wells. And that's, what you've seen on documentaries like Gasland, where people can turn on their taps and, light you know, what looks like light their faucets on fire. That's water that has been infused with methane, and it volatilizes into the air as soon as it comes out the faucet, and you can ignite it at that point.
Well, but the real point here is that if you have 4% leakage, it's a wash. You're no better off than you are with burning coal.
From a climate perspective, that's absolutely right. Now, I would not for a minute say that we shouldn't be closing our coal plants. We definitely need to close our coal plants. They're a climate disaster, and they're also a public health disaster for other reasons. They emit high levels of particulates and other air pollutants that are of serious concern from a public health perspective. So, you know, I wouldn't want your listeners to think that because we're very concerned about gas, it means that we should, you know, give coal a free ride. But what we do need to do is make absolutely certain that we slow down the development of gas, the new development, until we are absolutely certain we can contain the methane, and that where gas is being developed already, that we put in place much better regulations to control the releases than we currently have. And this is a real problem, not just for gas development. It's also a big problem for shale oil development. If you look in the Bakken shale up in North Dakota, where they are mostly developing oil, not gas, they are flaring off huge amounts of natural gas. They're treating it as if it's nothing but a waste product. And, you know, if you see pictures of the nighttime sky right now, North Dakota is as bright as Chicago because of all of the flaring, just burning off this methane. This is a capturable product. It's a usable product. And instead, it's simply being, you know, burned off. It's less serious problem for the climate when it's burned than when it's simply vented. But it should not be released at all. It should be captured at best and you know, put to use in more productive ways.
But which government agency? I mentioned the EPA. Mm-hmm. Obviously, they're involved, and you mentioned NOAA doing the imagery from the air of the leakage in Utah.
Yeah.
But we remember from the blowout, the BP blowout in the Gulf, how useless the Minerals Management Service were in their oversight of the drilling of that well that caused the worst environmental disaster, I think, in American history.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm concerned and skeptical about who is really and the oil and gas industry, of course, has tremendous political clout. So I would like to know who or what kind of agency oversight there is to stop these bad practices, to force the people in North Dakota who are making money off the oil to also make money off the gas that they're venting and flaring.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, who's in charge here? FERC? MMS?
Well,
who is?
Well, unfortunately, there is a multiplicity of agencies that oversee different portions of the industry. You know, first and foremost, it is EPA that should be regulating this. And EPA just recently went through a rulemaking process to improve its air pollution rules for this industry. It passed up an opportunity to focus directly on methane. It refused, actually, during that rulemaking process to do it. So when you ask who's really doing the enforcement, honestly, it's the citizens of the United States that are now doing the enforcement. Earth Justice is engaged in litigation to force the EPA to regulate methane directly. You know, in the transmission of the gas, you have Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, FERC. It should be doing a much better job investigating the climate impacts of the infrastructure that it's allowing to be built. It is not looking collectively at all of the pipelines or other types of infrastructure that's going in to figure out what are the climate impacts going to be from all of this. We have liquid natural gas export facilities that are being proposed now that will generate huge demand for more natural gas development. And FERC has not, neither Department of Energy nor FERC has undertaken a comprehensive study of what all of the more than a dozen pending proposals will do in terms of climate if all of this gas is extracted and then liquefied and shipped overseas and burned. So there's, you know, we really have an administration that's asleep at the watch with respect to climate impacts of the oil and gas industry. And it's, you know, it's really very distressing for those of us who understand the impact that this will have over the long term to see the industry back down from, see the administration and the agencies that are responsible for oversight backing down from opportunities to get some, at least, of this under control.
Well, but the administration, you say it's asleep at the switch. It's also celebrating this great switch that's underway to natural gas and the idea that the United States is becoming energy self-sufficient and we're surpassing Russia as the world's biggest producer of natural gas. Both the administration and the industry are celebrating this big change, but nobody's talking about whether or not, in fact, we're going to be worse off as a result of this. And if 4% leakage is enough to make it a wash in terms of the benefits of natural gas, and you say it could be as high as 14%, and that methane is 100 times worse in the short term than CO2 as a global warming gas, I'm not reassured.
I don't blame you. I'm not reassured either. Unfortunately, you know, we have a sort of what the government has described as an all of the above policy. Well, an all of the above policy is no energy policy at all. And what we really need is not investment in fossil fuels, but investment in clean, carbon-free, renewable energies. And, you know, one of the big concerns right now that we have is that because the gas industry has been going gangbusters to the point where it's actually caused a glut and has driven the price of gas down so far, it's undermining the ability of carbon-free renewable energies to compete. So it not only helps to close down the coal plants, which is a good thing, but it hurts in, you know, the pace of development towards something that would help us end our addiction to fossil fuels.
Well, Deborah Goldberg, I thank you so much for joining us here.
My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Deborah Goldberg, who's the managing attorney at Earth Justice, where she supervises and conducts legal advocacy and litigation related to global warming and environmental health. She served as a law clerk for then-Judge Stephen Breyer, now of the Supreme Court, on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the First Circuit. And before joining Earth Justice, she was the Democracy Program Director of the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU School of Law. We're going to take a brief station break and back talking about the philosophical underpinning of the Tea Party Republicans who want to shut the government down again.
Energy is becoming one of our country's greatest concerns. If we don't start working on energy conservation, there may not be enough energy to go around by the time I'm a parent. I'm going to talk about how we can solve some of our problems through alternative energy sources. You can learn more about energy, too. Call your county cooperative extension service for more information. Conserving energy is everyone's responsibility. Call 4-H to find out how you can do your part.
Bruce Rodner!
Sit down, man.
Glenn Beck!
Sit down, man.
Rand Paul!
Sit down, man.
LL Cool J!
Sit down, man.
Netanyahu!
Sit down, man.
Sarah Palin!
Sit down, man.
Newt Gingrich.
Sit down, man.
Toby Keith.
Sit down, man.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Michael Lind, who is the co-founder of the New America Foundation and policy director of New America's Economic Growth Program. He is co-author of The Radical Center, The Future of American Politics, and Made in Texas, George W. Bush and the Southern Takeover of American Politics. Among his other nonfiction books are The American Way of Strategy and What Lincoln Believed. And his latest book is Land of Promise, An Economic History of the United States. And his latest article at Salon is How Did Ayn Rand Become a Hero of Right-Wing Nerds Everywhere? Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Lind.
Thank you.
And this Ayn Rand, Anne, I guess is not the way it's pronounced, Ayn Rand, is actually her real name is Alyssa Rosenbaum. When she died, as you point out in your article at Salon, Michael, when she died in 1982, she was a leader of a marginal cult known as the Objectivists. Of course, the executor of her will was Alan Greenspan, who later led the Fed. But one of the ironies was that towards the end of her life, she was living on Social Security and Medicare.
Well, that's right. She was taking benefit payments from the state that she denounced as the evil ally of parasites. Although that's the least of her sins, if you ask me. She was wrong, you know, fundamentally wrong about the way the world works, to use Jude Winiski's term, and through no fault of her own, because she was sort of an intellectual mediocrity. She's become one of the patron saints of this emergent American right in the early 21st century, which is quite different from the conservative movement that we had from the 50s up until the end of the Cold War.
Well, she may well have been an intellectual lightweight, but that's not to suggest, you know, her legacy, of course, is extremely damaging, particularly if the Tea Party caucus, who the Republican leadership is having a hard time calming down, and they seem bent on shutting the government down sometime late in September.
And well, it's not just the Tea Party caucus. You have Paul Ryan back in 2005, before the term Tea Party was coined, telling people that, quote, the reason I got involved in public service, by and large, if I had to credit one thinker, one person, it would be Ayn Rand. So her influence has been growing on the top echelons of the American right.
Well, curiously, out here in Hollywood, where this program originates, she played a very important role in ginning up the blacklist, the House of Un-American Activities purge of Hollywood. And a lot of people out here think her motives were largely that she was a failed screenwriter and that she was motivated by bitterness, which, of course, is one of the things that people charge the communists for being, you know, bitter and envious.
I think the real parallel is with L. Ron Hubbard, the founder of Scientology, because he was a fairly unsuccessful science fiction writer who then founded Scientology Dianetics, this pseudoscientific cult, which now has enormous headquarters in Washington, D.C., among other places, and fervent followers around the world, disproportionately, I understand, in Hollywood itself. I just think it's important to make that point. That is, up until a few decades ago, really maybe up until a decade ago or so, Ayn Rand was seen, even by many conservatives, as a figure more like L. Ron Hubbard or Lyndon LaRouche, you know, than like Keynes or you know, even Reagan or Buckley or Goldwater or Milton Friedman.
Well, William F. Buckley wrote about Ayn Rand's book, Atlas Shrugged, that I had to flog myself to read it.
Buckley effectively drove Rand and her Objectivist followers out of the mainstream American right in the 1950s at the same time he was trying to purge the John Birch Society. It was all for naught, you know, because if you think about the history of the American right, you had Buckley, and then you later had neoconservatives like Irving Kristol, both of whom I knew, and I disagree with them, broke with them eventually, but, you know, they were sophisticated thinkers. And they were trying to drag the right out of what was called the fever swamps
you know, to have a real governing conservatism that could, you know, based on real scholarship and real thought, even if liberals and leftists disagreed with it. And that whole enterprise has just collapsed, really, in a decade or two. And today's right has much more in common with this really crazy right of the late 40s and early 1950s of the Birchers and of the and the Ayn Rand movement then. It hasn't really changed its character from that time until this.
But, of course, it's becoming more and more attractive, particularly to a lot of young people who are embracing libertarianism. Ron Paul often is in polls. It comes across as being the most popular. And certainly his demographics indicate that young conservatives seem to be flocking in that direction. His son, Rand Paul, is clearly running for president in 2016, as is or might well is Ted Cruz. You know, the freshman, they're both freshman senators. Ted Cruz is the one that's most vocal in shutting the government down as a way to defund Obamacare, which, of course, just a couple of days ago, the president in his press conference before going on his vacation said that the Republicans, the Holy Grail, the only unifying principle that they operate under is to deny 30 million Americans health care. So,
this gets to the heart of the basic debate on the left and the right. That is your movement, does it aspire to be a governing movement? Do you want to win power through elections and then run the country? Or do you see yourself as a counterculture, as a perpetual opposition, and you don't want to take over the system, you want to blow it up? And at different times in history, there was a powerful countercultural left in the 60s and 70s that had no interest in winning office. It rejected the whole system. We're seeing, elsewhere, I've called today's right a countercultural right. A lot of the energy that went into the left-wing counterculture of the 60s and 70s, particularly from young people, I think goes into this very rejectionist right. And it's very heady, you know. It's very seductive and charismatic because there's this claim that you alone know the secret, you know, that's denied to the media and all of the corrupt establishment, that you and your movement are these heroic martyrs. So there's this kind of self-mythologizing that goes on, and it's particularly attractive to young people who haven't had any experience with compromise and trade-offs. So I think that's what we're facing. We're facing a countercultural radicalism of the right.
And as your article at Salon, Michael Lynn, How Did Ayn Rand Become a Hero to Right-Wing Nerds Everywhere? You point out that back in 1961, in an article in Esquire, Gore Vidal wrote about Ayn Rand, quoting, "She has a great attraction for simple people who are puzzled by organized society, who object to paying taxes, who dislike the welfare state, who feel guilt at the thought of the suffering of others, but who would like to harden their hearts. For them, she has an enticing prescription. Altruism is the root of all evil. Self-interest is the only good. And if you're dumb or incompetent, that's your lookout."
Well, Buckley and Vidal were famously philosophical rivals and personal enemies for a while, more on Gore Vidal's side than on Buckley's. But to find that both Gore Vidal and William F. Buckley agreed in detesting Ayn Rand, that's one of the rare moments of consensus. I also quote in my Salon article Whitaker Chambers, the ex-communist who played a key role in the Alger Hiss case. And in launching the young Richard Nixon's career, he wrote a devastating review of Ayn Rand's novel Atlas Shrugged in 1957 in William F. Buckley Jr.'s National Review, the story, the flagship magazine of the conservative movement. And it's amazing how much her rhetoric seems like that of Romney's and the makers versus the takers. For example, I quote Chambers saying, "In Atlas Shrugged, all this debased inhuman riffraff is lumped as looters." That is a fairly inspired epithet. It enables the author to skewer on one invective word everything and everybody that she hates, fears, and hates. This spares her the plaguey business of performing one service that her fiction might have performed, namely that of examining human depth, how such a feeble lot came to exist at all, let alone be powerful enough to be worth hating and fearing. And that's true of radical ideologies in general, you know, whether it's anti-Semitism or some versions of the radical left, the enemy is supposed to be both all-powerful, but also it will crumble the moment you point it out, right?
Well, indeed, and you point out in your article, Michael Lind, you quote the other libertarian hero, Ludwig von Mises, who wrote to Ayn Rand saying, quoting, "You have the courage to tell the masses what no politician told them. You are inferior, and all the improvements in your conditions, which you simply take for granted, you owe to the efforts of men who are better than you."
well, this is a debate that's been going on recently, that is whether libertarianism comes more out of the classical liberal tradition, which libertarians claim. They're just old-fashioned classical 19th century liberals who were mugged by the New Deal and the welfare state, or whether, as Corey Robin has claimed recently, an intellectual historian, that Nietzschean elitism has a lot to do with it. And it's very interesting, in 1957, Chambers, you know, thought there was this elitist element. If you look at some of the influences on the libertarian movement in the mid-20th century, it's people like Albert J. Nock, and what they all shared was this fear and disgust and hatred of the masses. There was this pose that the superior person is being threatened by what Ayn Rand called the looters, you know, what Romney calls the takers. It's not fascist or authoritarian in the sense that you don't try to take over society. At least but the superior people, who in libertarian thought tend to be rich people, should secede from society and sever their connections, so that once they're protected from this mass of inferiors around them, but at the same time they owe them nothing.
Well, this new movie, Elysium, apparently deals to some extent with that notion of, in the future, I think it's 2054 or something, the elite live in these suspended space capsules above this toiling mass of putrid humanity.
Well, sounds like a libertarian ideal.
It is. It's the Untermensch. And that, of course, explains why the Tea Party people have such fealty to billionaires like the Koch brothers who fund them. But I think, though, in terms of politics and the way the 2014 election might play out, Michael Lind, given Obama seemed to fire an opening shot at the press conference on Friday, where he talked about the only unifying principle the Republicans have is to shut down Obamacare and to deny 30 million Americans health care. That's not appealing to that's appealing to Ayn Rand's idea of altruism is bad and greed is good, because what's underlying the working Americans on who vote against their own interests is that they believe that Obama is helping the freeloaders at their expense. Isn't that the subtext of the Republican message to ban or to defund Obamacare?
Yeah, but I don't think that Obamacare is the strongest card that the Democrats can play for two reasons. First, there's all these elaborate means tests and so on. It's not a simple universal program like Medicare and Social Security. And second, it hasn't really even come into play yet. Probably once it has been around for a decade or two, people will just take it for granted, and they might even identify with it at that point. It will be the new system, and they may support it. I think the strongest cards the Democrats have, and it's not original, of course, it's the defense of Social Security and Medicare, which are established, universal, middle-class, working-class programs that most Republican voters, according to polls, don't want tampered with. And that's the contradiction between the Republican voter base and the billionaires and the intellectuals that progressives, I think, can exploit. The fact that one of the central goals of this Ayn Rand libertarian conservative elite is privatizing or otherwise dismantling Social Security and Medicare, and their own voters don't want that. Unfortunately, in previous rounds of negotiations, President Obama has sort of met them halfway, you know, talking about changing inflation indexing to cut Social Security and saying we can't afford it. But I think that's the ultimate Achilles heel of Ayn Rand, if I can mix some metaphors, that at the end of the day, the even right-wing voters, they may be in favor of eliminating programs that benefit people who are unlike them, you know, means-tested programs for the poor, like food stamps. But they're never going to go along with the libertarian project of abolishing their own middle-class entitlements.
Well, Ayn Rand's namesake, Rand Paul, who Ron Paul...
Well, I'm told that he was not named after Ayn Rand, although it seems like quite a coincidence.
Yeah, well, what was he named after then?
I think a family member.
Oh, I see. Well, without him being necessarily named after her, he certainly is an acolyte and advocate. And he's clearly running for president, and I'm quite mystified as to why so many liberals, when he did a filibuster, a lot of liberal commentators were praising him, and I think just because he thinks it's okay for you to smoke dope and thinks the war in Afghanistan and these imperial wars are a terrible mistake. Liberals tend to overlook the fact that he's against everything else that they believe in.
Well, I would ask of those particular individuals, how progressive are they if their major issues are, say, civil liberties and drug use, rather than a minimum wage being a living wage, adequate elderly benefits, decent working conditions, and so on. The truth is,
minority rights. They're against the census.
But libertarian voters are found among the Democrats as well as among Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
And, I don't think that's a stable situation. At some point, they're going to group into one party. Now, my own view is, I'm not advocating this, I'm just as an analyst. I don't think there's any large-scale popular support for the basic libertarian economic program. So if all of the libertarians followed Rand Paul into the Republican Party, and it really became a consistently libertarian party, even isolationist in foreign policy and taking, the most rigorous views of civil liberties and surveillance, I think it would be a permanent minority party.
Well, just in closing, let me read the last bit of your article, quoting here from Gore Vidal, who wrote this in 1961. Ayn Rand's philosophy, in quotes, is clearly perfect in its immorality, which makes the size of her audience all the more ominous and symptomatic as we enter a curious new phase in our society. Moral values are in flux. The muddy depths are being stirred by new monsters and witches from the deep. Trolls walk the American night. Caesars are stirring in the forum. There are storm warnings ahead. Well, thank you, Michael.
They are, so batten the hatches.
I thank you for joining us, Michael Lind.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Michael Lind, who's the co-founder of the New America Foundation and policy director of New America's Economic Growth Program. He's the author of Land of Promise, an Economic History of the United States, and his latest article at Salon is How Did Ayn Rand Become a Hero of Right-Wing Nerds Everywhere? This has been Background Briefing. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Bye.